This season of The Francis Effect is sponsored in part by Franciscan Media, seeking to spread the gospel in the spirit of St. Francis. Franciscan Media publishes books by authors like Richard Rohr, Heather King, and Ronald Rollheiser. Get 25% off your first order in the store when you use the code FrancisFX, that's Francis, the letter F and the letter X, at franciscanmedia.org. That's franciscanmedia.org. This season of The Francis Effect is brought to you by Liturgical Press in Collegeville, Minnesota. Liturgical Press is a trusted publisher of resources on liturgy, scripture, theology, and spirituality, evolving to serve the changing needs of the Christian church. They produce resources for pastoral leaders, teachers, engaged learners, and all readers looking for quality books on faith and culture. Lit Press books are available at your favorite book retailer and online at litpress.org. That's litpress.org. Hello, and welcome to the Francis Effect Podcast. My name is David Dalt. I host a radio show called Things Not Seen about culture and faith, and I'm an assistant professor of Christian spirituality at the Institute of Pastoral Studies at Loyola University Chicago. I'm here with my friends Heidi Schlumpf and Father Dan Horan. Heidi is senior correspondent at National Catholic Reporter, a publication that connects Catholics to church, faith, and the common good with independent news, analysis, and spiritual reflection. Father Dan is professor of philosophy, religious studies, and theology, and director of the Center for the Study of Spirituality at St. Mary's College in Notre Dame, Indiana. He's also affiliated professor of spirituality at the Oblate School of Theology in San Antonio, Texas. Every couple of weeks, we get together to discuss news and events through a lens of our shared Catholic faith. Father Dan and Heidi, welcome to you both. Heidi, how have you been?
I'm having like a little bit of post-eclipse glow over here. I did not travel to go see the places where it was totality. And now that I saw videos of how things were there, I'm really kicking myself for not making the very traffic-y drive I heard to Indiana to see it. But even the 96% I think that we got here in Chicago was pretty cool. And I went out for a walk with my glasses and felt the temperature definitely dip, and we walked around and offered my glasses to various people on the street. It was really interesting. It really had me thinking about how ancient peoples who didn't understand such things must have interpreted such an interesting natural phenomenon. I'd love to hear about your eclipse watching, if you had any, when you guys share as well. But just a quick note that I'm excited about something coming up this week. In addition to, I know the Mataleva lecture, which Dan will talk about. But on Thursday, I'm going to downtown Chicago to WBEZ, our local NPR affiliate, to join a couple dozen other journalists nationally for a training offered by the Poynter Center that's about covering extremism in the United States for journalists. And I'm really interested in this as someone who's been covering extremism in the Catholic Church to get some additional training about this, especially as we move into some coverage I'll be doing in advance of the presidential election. So I know Thursday is going to be a very full day for everyone. I'm also going to be covering Cardinal Pierre speaking at Loyola on Thursday night. And so I actually have to cover him and not watch the Mataleva lecture, but I will be watching the video as soon as it's over, as I know that's something that you're busily preparing for, Dan.
Yeah, we're excited about it. And our third segment today is actually our esteemed 2024 Mataleva lecturer, Dr. Natalia Imperatore Lee. And we here at the Center for the Study of Spirituality and St. Mary's College and the Tri-Campus more broadly here at Notre Dame, we're all very excited about this annual event, which is so significant. We're actually coming up on almost 40 years of this lecture. So it's really exciting. So for those listening on Thursday morning, Thursday afternoon, you can see in the show notes or visit stmarys.edu/spirituality to find a free link to register for the webinar, for the live stream. And if you're in the Michiana or broader Midwest region and want to road trip it here to St. Mary's, the event is open to the public and free again at 7 o'clock p.m. Eastern time here on campus. So it's going to be great. And I think Heidi's conversation with Natalia is a great sort of preview of just what an amazing thinker, scholar, teacher, and lecturer she is. So we're thrilled. About the eclipse, I did not see the eclipse directly. I was on a plane flying back to the Midwest from London yesterday. We're recording this on Tuesday, so on the day of the eclipse, April 8th. And we were actually given updates by the pilot along the way. Before we took off at Heathrow, the pilot said a number of people have asked about the eclipse. Will we see it? We were actually heading into the totality trajectory over North America as it was coming up beyond Indiana, Ohio, New York, and as we were coming in toward Chicago. So we did actually intersect with it at one point, but because the sun was so high up above the plane, no one was able to see it. There were a few passengers I noticed who had the special glasses prepared to look out the window. The pilot kept saying whenever he made an announcement about updates about the trajectory and where we were going, he said, please do not look at the sun without those special glasses. So it was exciting. There was a point, maybe, I would say maybe a half hour, 45 minutes before we intersected with the trajectory of the eclipse, where even 35,000 feet above the clouds and everything, so we didn't have the issue that some people did with clouds, we could see a darkening outside, which was a little bit eerie, but it was never the full kind of blackout that folks in Indianapolis or Western New York saw. So I guess that's a bit of a bummer. I remember being in elementary school decades ago and seeing an eclipse and looking through a special toilet paper roll device. I think it was before they started making all those glasses, but we had some kind of special film we put on. And I remember that being cool, but it's been neat to see all the photographs and videos and text chains from my family who all live in Western or Central upstate New York. And so they didn't have to go anywhere. It came right over them, which was very cool. I should say I was flying back from England because I was attending and participating in the Thomas Merton Society of Great Britain and Ireland, which is an organization in Europe that promotes scholarship and enthusiasm for the work of the great Trappist monk and author Thomas Merton. This conference takes place every other year on the off year with the International Thomas Merton Society. And because of the pandemic and scheduling, this was the first time this society has met in person since 2018. So it was really nice to catch up with friends and fellow scholars of Merton, some folks I haven't seen in as long as 6 years. So shout out to all of my colleagues and friends across the pond. And I'm glad to be back and looking forward to our Matt Oliva lecture Thursday. David, you have had an up and down kind of time since we last talked. How are you doing, brother?
Well, first of all, I want to say my family did travel to the zone of totality. And so I did experience that. And I will say I have never, ever had anything like that because I've been in near eclipses before. And so I had just expected it would be like that, only darker, but it was not. Literally, like, suddenly night falls and animals come out for 3 minutes and you can look right at the sun and see the ring blazing in the sky and not burn your eyes. It was surreal and something that I'm very glad that we did, but it was complicated by the things that you're mentioning, Dan. So listeners, between the last time that I was here recording and now, I had a major health event. I had a blood clot form in my leg. I think the technical term for it is a deep vein thrombosis. And so that was the beginning of a very painful 2 weeks, and it happened almost literally right after we recorded. I had been having some trouble with my leg, and it had been being monitored, and it got worse, and so the doctor brought me in, and we did some tests, and this was located with ultrasound, and I have now been on blood thinners for the past 2 weeks, and it is definitely getting better. The pain is much less. I now have mobility. There were a couple days where I couldn't walk because the pain and the discomfort were so bad. And the real concern for something like this, of course, is that it would worsen and that it would lead to something called an embolism, either in the lungs, the heart, or the brain. So far, we have avoided all that, and we seem to be in the clear, knock on wood. But I do appreciate prayers, and I just want to tell everybody, listen to your body. I am pretty infamous for ignoring warning signs in my body. And I think now that I am in my well into my 50s, that needs to be a policy that needs to change. So coming out of this, I'm going to reorganize some priorities and some things, some ways that I have approached my work to try and keep the important things center and keep the stuff that is on the periphery not quite so important. But I'm doing all right. I am okay. I'm not going to be running any marathons anytime soon, but I am able to get up and move around and be functional again. And I am returning to health and I am being closely monitored. So that's what's going on with me. But in the midst of that, I am glad that we were able to travel and to go and see the eclipse. That is an event that I am glad I did not miss.
Well, we're glad you're doing better, David. I know that Heidi and I have been kept in the loop as your friend off air, as it were. And so we've been praying for you and in solidarity with you as you've been going through this. But yeah, what a scary event, what a scary encounter. So glad to hear things are on the mend.
Thank you.
And great advice, David, about listening to your body. I am going to give you a thumbs up on that. And I'm glad that you're on the mend. And I'm jealous about the trip. Did you hit a lot of traffic?
We did on the way back, but we took a route that allowed us to avoid some of the worst of it. So it didn't take us quite as long as it might have. So listeners, today on the program, we have three topics coming up for you. The first is we're going to be doing a dive into the recently released DDF document, Dignitas Infinita, and we're going to be talking about that in our first segment. In our second segment, we're going to be looking at the life and legacy of the recently passed Bishop Gumbleton. And then in our third segment, Heidi is interviewing the theologian and writer Natalia Imperatore Lee. So all of that is coming up here on the program. Please stay with us.
Welcome back to The Francis Effect. I'm Dan Horan, and I'm here with Heidi Schlumpf and David Dalt. Every couple of weeks, we get together to discuss news and events through the lens of our shared Catholic faith. On April 8th, the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith released a new declaration on the subject of human dignity titled Dignitas Infinita. The document is sweeping in its scope. It seeks to clarify and reaffirm many of the well-established teachings of the Church, particularly on subjects such as abortion, euthanasia, and assisted suicide. At the same time, the document seeks to extend that same settled clarity to a host of subjects currently under debate within the wider Church. For example, both war and the death penalty have been issues where the Church has historically ambiguous positions. This new document seeks to draw a brighter line on such issues, continuing a trend toward increasing clarification and absolute condemnation of war and the death penalty during the papacy of Pope Francis. These moves have drawn criticism from more conservative wings of the Church. Yet on the other side, Dignitas Infinita has drawn criticism for its summary dismissal of the experiences and perspectives of LGBTQIA+ persons, even as the document also seeks to affirm the, quote, infinite dignity, unquote, of those persons. Michael O'Loughlin, a journalist who has reported extensively on sexuality issues in the Catholic Church and who is now executive director of Outreach Catholic, described his feeling of, quote, whiplash, unquote, when reading the document, due to its mixture of both bright spots and condemnations for LGBTQIA+ communities. As O'Loughlin notes, and I quote, "It will be difficult for some LGBTQ Catholics to square this doctrinal document with the pastoral reality of Pope Francis, who has made meeting with LGBTQ people a not insignificant part of his papacy," unquote. David, you've mentioned that you've been working on a project dealing with queer theology. What has this document got you thinking about? Where should we start here?
Well, I want to say, first of all, that I am trying to receive this document in the most optimistic and generous light. And so I have written in scholarly circles that when Pope Francis uses terms like the poor or uses terms like dignified agency, which is the subject matter of the queer theology that I'm working on, he tends to use these phrases without fully developing them philosophically. And so in that sense, I welcome this document because it is an attempt to begin to philosophically develop the idea of dignity, the one half of the dignified agents phrase. However, even in that attempt, it remains a very underdeveloped document. It fails to engage with any of the current discourse, and I know, Dan, you're going to talk about this too, it fails to engage with any of the discourse that has recently been developed around particularly gender and gender theory, whatever that phrase might mean. So to really give my position on this, I look at documents like this as an invitation to conversation. However, the document as it is currently phrased, seems to not want to initiate conversation, but rather it wants to settle conversation and end it before a conversation has actually and properly been allowed to occur. And so for me, it's a document that is fundamentally confused in its structure, because it is seeking to shut down a conversation that literally has not happened yet, because one side has failed to listen to the lived experiences of some of the conversants. So I have a lot of mixed feelings. I will say I am very angry about this document, because when I first began to read it yesterday when it was released, I really felt that kind of end run attempt to shut down the conversation aspect of the document. In the 24 hours since, as I have returned to it, I have gotten more hope, and it is actually going to be a useful fulcrum point for me as I am working on various projects, including this queer theology, trying to look at Laudato Si and the idea of dignified agency. But it really is a kind of structural hot mess. And Dan, I'm saying all this realizing that you also, for New Ways Ministry, published a really excellent column looking at the kind of straw man aspects of this. And so I'd invite you to say more about that, because that I think that really undergirds what I'm trying to say here.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And first of all, I would say that I have a similar kind of initial take to you, David, that is both complex. I mean, on the one hand, there's a huge chunk of this document that's very good. On the other hand, the kind of parts that are not are deeply problematic and will likely be seized upon by people who are homophobic and transphobic. It's already being done, quite sadly. So more to say about that in a minute. But I do want to affirm, on the face, there's nothing really wrong with reasserting the inherent dignity and value of all people. That said, it becomes problematic when you start to erase the realities, the existence, the actuality of people and whole communities of people, which is in effect what this document does, if not always explicitly at the end, then tacitly when it comes especially to trans and genderqueer people. So I don't want to just brush over that, but like you, I've tried to take an optimistic reading of this text. I did write in that article for New Ways Ministry toward the end that this could have been worse. In fact, it's far better than a lot of what the U.S. bishops have been putting out in terms of regional dioceses and instructions, or even the atrocious document, the doctrinal note that the USCCB's Committee on Doctrine released last March that basically called for no medical interventions or any kind of gender-affirming care in Catholic hospitals and other institutions. This document falls short of that. It says, in effect, that it does not recognize the reality of sex change. And that itself is an interesting focal point, because a whole section, a whole kind of chunky paragraph 60 is titled Sex Change, but then doesn't take into account, as you rightly say, David, a lot of the developments in medical, psychological, science, and sociological studies and practices today. So there's a lot of incongruence. There's a lot of ambiguity. There's a lot of contradiction within the document itself. I liked your term. It's confused. It's a very confusing document on this particular subject when it comes to the LGBTQ plus community. And that confusion is going to lead to a lot of problems. On the one hand, an optimistic read, a glass half full read is, well, it's not clear enough to actually end the conversation that you're talking about. In fact, there are signs, including in the introductory or prefatory note from Cardinal Fernandez, that actually we need to engage more in contemporary academic research. On the other hand, zero academic research was engaged in this document. As one commentator pointed out yesterday, all the footnotes are self-referential. They're references to popes and to internal documents with zero consideration of the actual real scholarly serious work that's being done by philosophers, theologians, and scientists and physicians. So that's deeply problematic.
Just to contrast this quickly with Laudato Si, which I mentioned a moment ago, the engagement of Laudato Si with scientific discourse is very full and complete. And that really shows the contrast happening here. Heidi, I'm interested in your thoughts about this. Please tell us what you're thinking.
Well, first of all, kudos to Dan for getting a column out while from the airport and airplane.
True.
The journalist in me is very impressed with you having a really thoughtful, I know, first thoughts, but thoughtful commentary on the day it came out. I read a lot of news coverage and then read it in its totality last night. And the thing that struck me, I'm agreeing with much of what you guys have said already, was that introductory note at the beginning that described the process about how this is a document that has been in process since 2019. So, and before then. So I think to read about how the back and forth being found unsatisfactory initially, you can read between the lines there. And what I think I'm seeing in that note or surmising in that note is that it was majorly focused on gender issues and this gender ideology, and that the feedback, especially from Pope Francis, was that it needed to be broadened, and especially drawing on Fratelli Tutti to talk about this ontological or inherent infinite dignity of all people. So I too found a lot to chew on that I thought was very helpful in those first sections. And then when it got to the gender stuff, had a lot that I maybe didn't agree with. But I will say it seems to have pissed off people on both sides. So that's always a good sign. So I hear some other Catholics not happy with the discussion of the death penalty and how that seems to imply that we're continuing to move on that teaching in terms of the inherent dignity, even of people who have done horrendous things. So yeah, I think there'll be some interesting analysis of the process going forward when we can really hear what happened.
And thank you for talking about that 5-year span. If we go back 5 years, that's about the time that Judith Butler, who is a major figure for theorizing questions of gender, was introducing a new sort of discourse and reflection on nonviolence. And particularly, they introduced the question of grievability as a kind of way of thinking about humanity and human dignity, and how greatly this document would have benefited if it had actually gone into the gender studies discourse inaugurated by people like Dr. Butler, and then had proceeded to say, and Dr. Butler has also given us a wonderful tool for thinking about human dignity. But because it was so anemic and unwilling to engage with any of this, it avoided real tools that could have helped strengthen its discussion.
Yeah, I'm a little sheepish mentioning this because it implicates me, but Professor Judith Butler, they have a new book out, which is really extraordinary, and I'm a little bit biased because I'm one of two Catholic theologians cited by Butler, the only one named in the text itself, but I'm in good company because Professor Elizabeth Johnson is the other one. So when Elizabeth Johnson and Dan Horan are cited, I feel like I'm not worthy to untie her sandals, so that is Professor Johnson, but deeply honored that Professor Butler has actually taking the time to read not just us as constructive, systematic theologians, but also to take very seriously documents that have come out in recent years from the Vatican. It's for those of us who've studied Butler's work for a long time, we get tripped up at times on pronoun usage because they've only recently adopted they/them pronouns. So I apologize, as I do to my students, when referring to Butler, slip back and forth between those. But one of the things that they do is focus on the ways in which gender, just as a kind of megalith, like gender as a sort of, or metonym, has been invoked by right-wing political ideology and nationalism, leading to fascism in many contexts, including in the United States and parts of Europe and elsewhere, but also the role of religion, particularly Roman Catholic Christianity, the Vatican in particular, and certain evangelical strains of Christianity have really, as you said, David, particularly in the last 5-6 years, seized on this in a way that has become deeply troubling and problematic with real life consequences. I will say, again, full disclosure about my work being engaged by Professor Butler, the book itself is really wonderful. It's in terms of its readability, which is somewhat ironic because those who know Butler's academic work, they're renowned for having very thick, very subtle and obtuse academic writing. But they went through a lot of effort, went to great lengths to make this a very readable text. And I encourage people to do that. And I agree with you, David, what that would have meant to see a document. The DDF is headed up by and staffed by a lot of really good theologians and philosophers. These are people who are smart people. Wouldn't it have been interesting for them to take Butler as seriously as Butler is taking them?
I'm so glad you mentioned that, Dan, because I had read somewhere about how you and Beth Johnson were quoted in their book, and I really definitely noticed that. And so I'm glad you pointed that out to our listeners. The other context that I'm thinking of, and I'm grateful for you bringing that up about how Butler does put it in the context of some of this other extremism around issues. I've got extremism on the brain again because of my event this week. Yesterday's news, in addition to being the eclipse, in addition to this document dropping, former President Trump also made his announcement finally about abortion. And his announcement was that he is stepping back, isn't going to support a ban, and instead wants to leave it to the states. And some pro-life anti-abortion activists were upset about that. But I think it indicates that this extremist position is finding pushback among people who have to live these issues on the ground. And so when this document comes out from the Vatican that also pushes back on another area of gender and sexuality, I think we need to spend a little bit more time, like you said, Butler does, integrating what's going on in people's actual lives. So I know other people have raised the issue that it's unclear or maybe even obvious that transgender people were not consulted or spoken with, or at least not cited in this document in terms of what their experience would be. We know that Pope Francis does meet with transgender people. So I think those people were especially disappointed that doesn't seem to be reflected in this document. But again, it's a relatively brief document from the DDF. This is not an encyclical. And I think that we can hope that maybe some of these things progress in the future.
Well, I was going to bring up that same point. I'm glad you did, Heidi, which is to draw attention to the fact that this is not a magisterial document. It's a declaration from a Vatican dicastery. It's important. It's meant to provide clarification, as David said from the outset. But this is not definitive church teaching. That's really important. There is no exercise of ordinary or extraordinary magisterium here. Again, I want to be clear. This doesn't mean this is a nothing burger. No one needs to take this seriously or engage it. We do. But there are levels to church teaching. The Second Vatican Council makes that very clear. Great theologians over the years have done really important work to help us to understand that. And this is not something that rises very high. I mention that because, David, you contrasted this, and I think rightly so, methodologically, with something like Laudato Si, which, as Pope Francis makes clear, is part of Catholic social teaching. It is an encyclical letter. It's ordinary magisterial teaching. That is non-negotiable, right? And so that has a weight that needs to be taken far more seriously than even important documents like this. I say that again because I think people will latch onto this in as you said, Heidi, people are upset on quote-unquote both sides. The people who are transphobic, who will want to use this against the LGBTQ community for whatever nefarious reasons, will latch on to and proof text what they want. Some of these same people might want to blanketly ignore the prohibition against the death penalty or some of these other subjects that are in here. And that's wrong. Likewise, there will be people who are very upset about this because, as I and David and many other people are, about the kind of disingenuousness, the ambiguity, the confusion, the sloppiness, I would say, of creating straw men, straw people, in this case, of, quote, gender theory without any explication or any resources. This will be used, again, in ways people will say this is an attack. And in many ways, it could be, but it's the worst of both worlds in this regard. And my kind of approach to this moving forward is, okay, where does this create spaces for continued engagement, reflection, study, and scholarship? More conversation has to take place. This has settled absolutely nothing. And on the one hand, both sides will be upset about that. On the other hand, I think this is how the Catholic Church does its best thinking. From a theological perspective and a historical perspective, the fact is there's one line, I think it's at the end of paragraph 59, where this document says something like, in response to, quote, sex change, or maybe this is in paragraph 60, that there can be no, quote, unquote, sex change as this document understands what sex is. And I think that's a fair statement because it's circular reasoning, right? It's solipsism. It's a kind of internal logic. And that if you, according to their categories, this is impossible and therefore it doesn't happen. Okay, well, then we need to engage those presumptive categories, right? We need to actually draw from people's experiences and other forms of scholarly investigation to say, well, maybe the premises are faulty. And we have done that as a church before around slavery, around usury, around religious freedom. The list goes on. So I am optimistic, not Pollyannish, because there will be people who will use this for harm.
Well, listeners, at the outset, I mentioned that I am trying to treat this as a document that invites conversation. And let me just briefly say a little bit more about that. In the Catechism of the Catholic Church, we are reminded that Christianity is not a religion of the book, but rather is a religion of the living Word of God. I have always interpreted that particular passage from the Catechism to mean that when we encounter a written text, it doesn't stop the conversation, but rather it becomes an invitation for us to go more deeply in conversation with one another, even conversation across deep disagreements, which is what I think synodality is all about. And so I am inviting you, along with me, to view Dignitas Infinita as an invitation to a deeper and more rich conversation, even a conversation across disagreements, even a conversation across chasms with those who may consider themselves my enemy or your enemy in this debate. And so let us be prayerful and mindful as we engage in this discussion that in the end, Christ is all in all. And that is finally what we are trying to work towards here, is a place where Christ is honored in our discussions and even in our, dare I say it, dissents. Okay, we are going now to leave this conversation and move on to our next segment. You're listening to The Francis Effect. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to The Francis Effect. I'm David Dalt, and I'm here with Heidi Schlumpf and Father Dan Horan. Every couple of weeks, we get together to discuss a variety of topics from a perspective informed by our Catholic faith. Last Thursday, April 4th, Bishop Thomas Gumbleton, the retired Auxiliary Bishop of Detroit and champion of social justice, died at the age of 94. A Detroit native, Gumbleton was ordained to the ministerial priesthood in 1956 and then as auxiliary bishop for Detroit in 1968 at the age of 38, making him the youngest Catholic bishop in the United States at that time. He's an ardent defender of the dignity of the human person and social justice, leading and participating in protests against the Vietnam War, the stockpiling of nuclear weapons, and the American training of Salvadoran military officials at the School of the Americas in Georgia. Gumbleton was a founding member of Pax Christi USA and one of the authors of the 1983 USCCB document, The Challenge of Peace, God's Promise and Our Response. In recent decades, Gumbleton has also been a powerful voice of advocacy on behalf of victims of clergy sexual abuse. According to one report, quote, in 2006, he gave written testimony to Ohio state legislators revealing his own sexual abuse by a priest and supporting an extension of the state statute of limitations in sexual abuse cases, unquote. This, in turn, angered many of his fellow bishops, and he was accused of violating, quote, communio episcoporum, unquote, the communion of bishops, among other statutes in the Code of Canon Law, which led to his being removed from serving as a pastor of a parish in Detroit. He has also been a vocal supporter of women and the LGBTQ plus community in the church. Last year, Frank Fromhertz and Sister Suzanne Sattler published a biography of Gumbleton titled No Guilty Bystander, The Extraordinary Life of Bishop Thomas Gumbleton. Dan, you had the opportunity to meet Bishop Gumbleton on several occasions. What are some of your recollections about this extraordinary pastoral leader in the American church?
Yeah, I think you said it well, extraordinary pastoral leader. We were just talking a bit off air, in the three of us, about what we often talk about on this podcast, which are at times the kind of negative remarks, the kind of exclusionary or discriminatory statements or behaviors of some of the bishops in the United States. Again, not all of them. But Bishop Gumbleton was a real sort of example of somebody who walked the walk, not just talked the talk of the gospel. And in so many ways, David, you highlighted so many of them just now. I have one personal story that it makes me smile every time I think about it. A couple of years ago, I was here in the Center for the Study of Spirituality, and I was talking with a colleague, and we were just chit-chatting, and I heard my phone ringing in my office. I said, oh, I should probably go get that. And I pick up the phone, and I hear on the line, is this Dan Horan? Moran? I said, yes. And the person on the other line said, this is Bishop Tom Gubbleton. You probably don't know me, but I said, Bishop Gumbleton, yes, I know you. I know who you are. And we just proceeded to have a very lovely conversation. He was calling to invite me to be part of a lecture series that he was not directly involved in, but he has been a supporter of in the Detroit Archdiocese for many years. And he was very forthright. He said, I don't do all the planning, though I'm really excited that we're inviting you to come. But he said, the committee has always believed that if a bishop calls, the people are more likely to say yes. And I said, Bishop Gumbleton, that theory has proven true here, because whatever you ask of me, I will do. I'll be deeply honored. And so that makes me smile, because he was so humble about it. He just said he didn't presume anyone would know him, even though he was, and certainly in many circles in the U.S. Catholic Church, and beyond, quite frankly, in the global South, around the world, a real champion of the most marginalized and oppressed people, a champion for peace and justice, for racial justice, for broader inclusion of women in the church, of the LGBTQ community. And as you said, David, on behalf of victim survivors of clergy abuse, he himself having shared that he was a survivor of clergy abuse, that led to his being removed from a pastoral appointment because his fellow bishops were upset that he was supporting the opening of the statute of limitations so that victim survivors could receive some kind of accounting for what they had suffered, what they had experienced. And so he was, for those of us who've had the pleasure to meet him in person and know him, a very gentle human being and a very kind person. I know he had a column at NCR for many years. And so, Heidi, I don't know if you have any personal recollections to kick us off.
I'm sure that I've been at conferences that he's been at, but I don't know that I have any personal stories, except to say he did have this connection, not only with NCR officially, because we ran his homilies as a column called The Peace Pulpit. And I think they only ended just a few years ago, so into his 90s. But certainly he had a connection with so many of our readers and with the whole generation of the Vatican II Catholics, for whom he was such a leader, because he reflected in the leadership so many of the things that were of concern to them. So nonviolence and peace and anti-war and poverty and other issues of social justice. And then later adding these issues around LGBTQ issues as his own brother came out, and he had to wrestle with that and came out and the bishop then had this loving, very Christian reaction to that. And then the issue of clergy sexual abuse. So I know some people came up to me at Mass this Sunday and were reflecting on the obituary that we had. We also had an interview with him just 2 years ago. I think it was for the 50th anniversary of Pax Christi. And it was surprising to me, like in his 90s, how forward thinking he was. He was obviously looking back at the last 50 years, but also very engaged with the issues of the day, racism. So I think there's so much to be inspired by from his life. But then this little bit of sadness that there aren't that many bishops like him. And there was a time when there were. So he was certainly singularly brave, and I think much a leader even among the bishop friends. But it used to be that the bishops' conference was full of a lot more people like that than there is today. And really, there is such, when you reflect on his life, there really is a stark contrast with the leadership of the bishops' conference today.
For me, I'm really amazed by this outpouring, because as a convert to Catholicism and a person who has tried to be very widely read in the church in the more than decade and a half that I've been involved in Catholic issues, I know that I have encountered Bishop Gumbleton's name on occasion, but I had no idea the influence and the legacy. And so this is the value, even in passing, of a person who lives this kind of life and has this kind of vocational witness, because it is, if I may say, a gift that keeps on giving. If you can be a priest or an episcopal leader with integrity and with coherence of vision and with a real love for the core teachings of the church and the gospel of Jesus Christ, your life can continue to have ripple effects even well beyond your earthly time and your ministry. So I'm delighted, just as a person who's only just now learning about Bishop Gumbleton, to be exposed to this and to know that there are columns that I can go back and read, that there are legacies that I can go back and explore, and that there is a model for a particular type of Episcopal witness that I can raise up and say, yes, let us have more bishops like this.
And I think, to be fair, there are bishops, even in our own day. Sadly, I think they're a numerical minority among the USCCB. But I'm thinking, of course, of Bishop John Stowe of Lexington, who is quite literally one of Gumbleton's successors as the Episcopal advisor, I think it's called, or something to that effect, of Pax Christi USA, and a previous guest even this season here on The Francis Effect. I'm thinking of Bishop Mark Seitz down in Texas and Archbishop John Wester in Santa Fe, who have done just tremendous work without regard for their own sort of how they're going to be viewed by their fellow bishops or by politicians or by naysayers who, you know, would take issue with their defense of, in the case of Bishop Stowe, for instance, the LGBTQ community, or in the case of Bishop Seitz of the migrant community or the kind of anti-gun work that he's done, or Bishop Wester in his advocacy for nuclear disarmament in the wake of the past century of this horrible sword of Damocles hanging over the world. And in many ways, they remind me of the kind of witness that Bishop Gumbleton offered, not without cost. And I think it's worth mentioning, too, in Bishop Gumbleton's own history, that he was ordained in 1968 at the young age of 38. He was younger than I am now when he was ordained a bishop. And for somebody to be identified for Episcopal leadership at such an early age, just a little more than a decade after being ordained a ministerial priest, would ordinarily anticipate a kind of long career of maybe moving up from smaller to larger dioceses and this sort of thing. And yet he only held one position his whole episcopacy, which was as an auxiliary, not even the ordinary, an auxiliary bishop in Detroit. And many observers, including himself in several interviews, acknowledged that his never, quote unquote, moving up, if we want to use that language, was because he would speak the hard truths. He would stand with people who were not popular, who were at the margins. He would be saying things that I think really rang true in the gospel spirit that ruffled the feathers of his own fellow bishops or of maybe donors or of people who found that discomforting or challenged their comfortable or powerful worldview. And to me, that's really admirable. I think we see a freedom that comes with living the gospel and living it to the full without self-editing, without censorship. We see this in U.S. politics when you hear all the kind of off-the-record remarks of, let's say, Republican Congress people and senators who say, oh, we don't agree with this and we don't like these policies and this bombast, but then very publicly will support positions and politicians and figures like candidate Donald Trump, even if privately they disagree with them, because they don't want to step out. They don't want to expose themselves. And I think this is true also in the church, because the church is made up of human beings. And the church is also political. It is a polis, a gathering of people who organize themselves. Again, hopefully inspired by the Spirit, but a lot of those same temptations and pressures come to fore. And I think Bishop Gumbleton was somebody who was truly prophetic in the Old Testament sense, that was not afraid to do the hard thing because that's what God was calling him to do. And man, what a legacy he left us.
Thank you, Dan, for bringing up some examples of current bishops who are also in that mold. I didn't mean to imply there were none, but it is a minority. And as you were naming them, Bishop Stowe and Wester and Bishop Seitz, it reminded me what they have in common with Bishop Gumbleton was this idea of listening to people and an inductive see, judge, act way of approaching things. So listening to the experiences of people. For Bishop Gumbleton, whether it was people who were suffering in Haiti or his LGBTQ brother or to other victims of clergy sex abuse. And so I think that this kind of references back to our first segment where we were concerned that the document that came out of the Vatican didn't do that and has more of a deductive sort of top-down rules, and philosophy focus. There's room for both perspectives, obviously, in approaching any issue, but too often in our church, the inductive is just pushed to the side. And I'm so grateful to Bishop Gumbleton and the bishops today who do approach things that way, especially in this time of synodality. And thank you, David, for reminding me that probably a whole generation of Catholics might not be aware of him and that there is this resource in his legacy.
I'll definitely link to his biography in the show notes, and I'm planning to read it now because, again, I literally had no idea that this person existed and that this ministry was so rich and varied and so long-running. It's a wonderful thing.
I think, Heidi, you brought up something really important, too, about the listening. And in some ways, Bishop Gumbelton anticipated the papacy of Pope Francis at its best, which is a listening church, a synodal church, where we accompany one another, where we hear each other. As you rightly said, hearkening back to our previous segment, I think that the Church Universal still could be better at listening to all. But Bishop Gumbelton was changed by the experiences that he had, being humble, being open to viewpoints, realities different from his own. And I think sometimes that's the fear that keeps some of his brother bishops from following the gospel maybe as fully as Bishop Gumbelton did. I don't mean to just pick on bishops, because it's ordinary Christians, it's women religious and diocesan priests and all of us who face that same struggle. We're all called through baptism to be priests, prophets, and kings in the mold of Jesus Christ. And that prophetic call is really challenging because, as I often like to say, all of the Old Testament prophets try to get out of that gig. No one wanted to do it. And especially if you're an ambitious person or an insecure person or a person who desires a status quo comfort, it's really hard to live the life that Bishop Gumbelton did, where he basically had that one job for 50 years. So I really admire him. I think he was in so many ways a living saint, a real prophet in the biblical sense. His presence is deeply missed, I know, by many. And I hope that especially those of the newer generations, thinking of Gen Z and their commitment to authenticity and their work on behalf of justice and concern for so many peoples in the whole world, that his story might be one that inspires them to not lose faith, to stay in the church, to take seriously what Jesus calls us to. So Bishop Gumbelton will remain in my prayers. I know he accompanies us in our own Christian journeys. And I hope for those of you, maybe like our brother David here, who may not have known about Gumbelton beforehand, that you take advantage of some of the resources to learn more about his life and legacy.
Well, and listeners, on that note, we're going to leave the discussion here and turn in our next segment to Heidi's interview with the theologian and writer Natalia Imperatore Lee. That's coming up here on The Francis Effect. Please stay with us.
Welcome back to The Francis Effect. I'm Heidi Schlumpf with today's guest, Dr. Natalia Imperatore Lee, Professor of Religious Studies at Manhattan College in New York and Chair of the Religious Studies Department there. Dr. Imperatore Lee will be giving this year's Mataleva Lecture at St. Mary's College in Notre Dame, Indiana. Since 1985, the Mataleva Lecture has featured prominent women theologians speaking on various aspects of feminist theology. Her lecture is titled, quote, Bearers of an Idle Tale, Women's Authority in a Credibility Economy. Dr. Imperatore Lee is the author of two books, including Quintime, Narrative in the Ecclesial Present, and Women in the Church, From Devil's Gateway to Discipleship. She writes and teaches about ecclesiology, or the study of the church, especially its intersection with feminist and Latinx Catholic thought. Other research interests include gender and sexuality, Mariology, and the relationship of women, the poor, and other marginalized groups to church structure and governance. Welcome to The Francis Effect, Natalia.
Thanks, Heidi, for having me.
We're all getting very excited about your lecture. By the time this drops, it'll be the morning of April 11th, which is the evening of your lecture, the Mataleva Lecture at St. Mary's. And a note to listeners, you can either come in person if you're nearby, or you can watch via the live stream. And we'll share in the show notes a link so that you can register for that. I got a bit of a preview of some of the themes when you gave another talk last month that was part of a series for Fairfield University and co-sponsored by Commonweal Magazine. And in that talk, you spoke a bit about women's experience and whether or not society and the church sees women as having the credibility to tell their own stories. So without giving away too much about your forthcoming lecture, could you tell us a little bit about this topic, why you chose it, and what you're hoping to share?
Thanks, Heidi. Yeah, I'd love to. First of all, if you're listening to the podcast, send up a prayer because I'm sure I'll be freaking out on April the 11th in the morning or whenever it is. Yeah, I was actually very grateful to Nancy Della Valle at Fairfield for inviting me to do a little bit of a preview because it helped me to think through some of these things. The Matalieva lecture is like a huge dream come true for me. I'm probably like the only dork in the world who read a Matalieva lecture in high school. And I was like, wow, people can do this. This is amazing. So I'm really, really stoked for it. The impetus for the lecture was actually my own anxiety about and fear for the synod and the limits of Pope Francis when talking about women generally. Like, I'm terrified. There's a new thing on human dignity coming out supposedly April 8th. And I'm just like white knuckling it because it's just, it's going to have something very weird in it. But we keep talking about listening and listening to women and how important it is to listen. And the synod is all about listening and we have to be a listening church. But a lot of times I feel like listening is insufficient. We listen to a lot of things, but none of them move us to action. So I think that there's a step there beyond listening or a next step that needs to happen, or maybe it's before, I don't know. And it's the step of credibility. We listen a lot, but do we believe people? Do we change our behavior because of what we hear? Do we let it move us in any way, right? And I do think that sort of Pope Francis has talked about this. And even I think Benedict XVI may have spoken about this, about dialogue as genuine dialogue being a willingness to change. But I just don't think listening is it. And I'm scared because a lot of the moves that Francis has made, so putting women in positions of decision-making ability or inviting women to the synod or whatever, it's always like women are always participating in a conditional way. It always depends upon some sort of permission structure that's run entirely by men.
Let me jump ahead to a question about the synod then. And as you said, it's about the church trying to be more of a listening church. Obviously, some of the issues that have been raised in the process have to do with the roles of women in the church. So what are you thinking about in terms of, we've had listening at the more grassroots level, and then we had listening at the global level last October, and we're coming up then on this October for that final Vatican level meeting. Would you call yourself optimistic or no? Or what are you thinking about the whole process?
I wish I were optimistic. I want to be optimistic. This is one of my unbelief moments. I want to be more optimistic than I am. The whole time, the sort of final document or the final outcomes were going to be written by clerics. And so, yeah, I feel like there's this gatekeeping structure that no matter how much listening we do, it's still by the permission or at the pleasure of a certain class of powerful men. So look, for instance, at the difference between how the synod has functioned in this country versus so many other countries around the world, right? Precisely because it depended upon the willingness of the bishops to participate, right? The bishops were the gatekeepers there. And so when some of the U.S. bishops just opted out of the synod or slow rolled it or however it was that it happened, the synod hasn't really happened in this country. There haven't been these widespread meetings. There haven't been these sort of in-depth conversations on the parish level or the diocesan level or whatever. And so it's one thing to say, let people be at the table. And another thing altogether to have people decide the menu, send the invitations, set the priorities, et cetera. I think that one of them is justice and the other one is not.
Yeah, good points. Another issue that you raised in the Fairfield talk that really resonated with me was how each generation seems to need to rediscover feminist theology, even though feminist theology has been going on for decades and decades. So why do you think that is? And what, if anything, can be done about this problem of feminist theology being under the radar in some Catholic circles?
Yeah, it's something that's been frustrating. I've been teaching for 17 years. And I have yet to encounter a student that has read a piece of feminist theology before they come to me.
Not one.
Not one.
Wow.
None of it. It's just not making it into the high schools. And it's not happening at Mass. So I don't know. Well, I have suspicions about why it is. I think a lot of even well-meaning theology professors of a previous generation probably left women and non-white theologians to the last 2 weeks of class when students are basically not paying attention anymore or working on final papers. So it's not stuff that sticks with people who end up then going into high school teaching. That could be one reason. I think that's changing a little bit. More of us are reworking our syllabi again. So that's not a supplement to theology, but a sort of central driving feature of theology. But I also think that the average Catholic gets most of their theology from Mass. And so if this is never part of the Mass, if priests never read feminist theology or never find it to be intriguing or important, and women are not allowed to preach at Mass, then the contributions and thoughts of women about God remain marginalized, and every generation has to discover it anew. You're having to start from zero every single time, so you feel very much like Sisyphus. So I think that feminist work isn't read in seminaries for whatever reason, and therefore it does not filter into what I do believe is an overburdened priestly caste. They are asked to do so much. They don't have a lot of extra time to do reading on the side or take enrichment classes or anything like that. So we're left with, maybe if you're lucky and you went to a Catholic college, which is expensive, you may have gotten one or two classes where you have the opportunity to read feminist theology. That's not enough. There has to be a kind of institutional push.
I think many of our podcast listeners would probably go to and read the work of theologians. So maybe, to do this quickly is unfair to even ask you, but what are some of the feminist theologians that you think maybe our listeners would like to know about, ones who have been influential in your work? In what ways?
Yeah, I mean, I think the most accessible feminist theologian is Beth Johnson. Elizabeth Johnson is a New York Sister of St. Joseph of Brentwood. She was my undergraduate teacher, and she was a third grade teacher before she went to graduate school. So she is really very good at breaking things down into accessible, organized lessons. And she's a very prolific writer. She has written about Mary. She has written about God. She has written about the church. So she's systematic and broad, but also very accessible in her writing. So her book, She Who Is, I think, probably one of the most foundational works of feminist theology. And it just invites us to think like the ancients thought, to think really beyond the categories that we rely on for God, which is actually a very traditional, very much a return to orthodox traditional thinking about God. So she's great, but so is Shawn Copeland. Who has thought so carefully and so intensely about theological anthropology and the Black body, for example. She's so good. This is someone I read as an undergraduate and I didn't really like it. And now as I've gotten older, I have so much more of an appreciation for her. She's so committed to the church. She's also excellent. But for this lecture, especially, and lately as I ease into middle age, I find myself really inspired by younger scholars, people like Aaron Kidd, who are working on epistemic violence and testimonial violence and sexual abuse survivors, for example, or Megan McCabe, who works on rape culture as social sin. These are people who are doing really interesting, cutting edge stuff that matters. And especially for your younger listeners, or for your listeners that have younger family members who are over the Catholic Church. These are great entry points that I certainly are successful with my students.
It's so great that you highlight such diversity in the people you name. And obviously there's a billion people that we've left off there because there's so much good work being done. I wanted to ask you a little bit about this trend that I observe, in part because I'm in the news and I'm seeing this among both in like evangelical Protestant, but some Catholic circles, this phenomenon called like trad wives, referring to ultra traditionalist or conservative women who are choosing this kind of pre-1950s life, who insist that being subservient to their husbands and being stay-at-home moms and housewives. And I just wonder if that's a trend that you notice and if you have any thoughts about that, especially if you see it manifesting itself in Catholic circles.
I actually talk about this a little bit in class because we use TikTok a lot to connect intergenerationally, like what I see on TikTok versus what my students see on TikTok. And the trend wife influencers that I see are very much suffering from the Phyllis Schlafly problem, right? Where women should all stay at home and not have careers. Meanwhile, they are monetizing and basically making a career of not having a career. And it certainly has not been real, certainly not for the vast majority of American women, right? It was that lifestyle, that June Cleaver lifestyle, was only accessible to very privileged white women and relied very much on the labor of non-white women. And so if that's something that God wants for all women, why has God left Black and Latina women and Asian women out of that plan? So many Black women, especially in the South, were employed in the houses of these quote-unquote traditional wives, making their lives possible, right? I think it's appealing to young people because adulthood is so hard right now and seems impossible. So the trappings of adulthood, or successful adulthood, I should say, are inaccessible, I think, unimaginable to young people, right? Having a house and a career and children. And I don't think that the tradwife movement, I think it's fun as an escape to think about, but it doesn't really take into account the reality of how difficult it is to have a child and raise a child in a country with as precarious and paltry a social safety net as the United States has. And I've seen, the funny thing is that on my TikTok feed anyway, you get the post-tradwife women, the women who did give up careers and college and stuff like that, and then found out their husbands were cheating, which happens, or that their children are grown. And so, yeah, you see a lot of these women who are now struggling with a husband that doesn't respect them or didn't respect his marriage vows, and they are really in a bind.
Well, and I thought this might happen, that if they were living in what they thought was the 1950s, we would have to have the 60s all over again. And maybe they'll pick up some feminist or feminist theology that would speak to them at that point. And people need to hear things when they hear them. But I wanted to ask you, too, a little bit about Latinx theology. And I know you've written about this, and it overlaps with some of the feminist theology that you do. Pretty soon, if not already, roughly half of U.S. Catholics are Latino. Pretty soon, they'll be the majority. I think I have that stat correct. So can you talk a little bit about that influence, especially about Latina women? What are they bringing to the church?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think if we can hold on to young Latinos, which is a big if right now, then it will have profound effects, I hope, on the church. Many of my students, and I teach here in the Northeast, so many of my students are Caribbean Latinos. So the Dominican Republic, Puerto Rico, Cuba, to a less extent. And you have people who are culturally very Catholic, who don't go to mass, but do a lot of home rituals. That's always been the case for Latinos. Less of a parish-dependent Catholicism and more sort of affinity group kind of Catholicism. And you're seeing that already happen in the broader church with church shopping and whatnot. But I think Latinos are accustomed to this kind of Catholicism. And I write about that a little bit in Cuéntame. But also, as we move away from affiliation and toward this whatever new thing is happening with young people. So yeah, I think what I think is really powerful about Latino Catholicism is its resilience. So in the face of institutional indifference or outright hatred, I think Latino Catholicism is just, it sticks with people, the spirituality, the imagery, it just becomes part of you. And I think in an era of increased disaffiliation, that level of resilience might prove handy and hopeful for the future of the church.
Well, that is a good thing to end on, unless there's anything else that you would like to add for our listeners.
No, just more prayer requests.
We will all be praying on the morning of Thursday, April 11th, and very much looking forward to hearing you talk more about credibility and authority and women's voices and women's stories. I'm really excited for your lecture. And thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast.
Thank you, Heidi, so much.
This is David. Just want to say that if you want to listen to the entirety of this interview with Heidi, you can do so at our Patreon page. That's patreon.com/FrancisFXPod. Thank you for listening. On behalf of Heidi and Father Daniel, we'll be back in a couple of weeks. We're very glad to have been with you today. Thank you so much. This has been The Francis Effect. The Francis Effect is produced by Sandberg Media, LLC, and is recorded remotely in Chicago, Illinois, and South Bend, Indiana. It's edited by me at the William Adams Studios in Hyde Park on Chicago's beautiful South Side. The opinions of this program are our own and do not reflect the positions of any organizations with which we may be affiliated. We want to give a shout out to the Salt and Light Catholic Media Foundation. They are not affiliated with our program, but they did give us their kind permission to use the name The Francis Effect, and we appreciate it very much. Please check out their good work at slmedia.org. This show is made possible in part by our Patreon supporters, and if you'd like to join them, please go to patreon.com/FrancisFXPod. We appreciate it very much. Please follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Both of those are at FrancisFXPod, and our website is also FrancisFXPod.com. Please tell your friends about the show, and if you're here for the first time, we have seasons and seasons of episodes that you can go back to and listen to for your heart's content. We're so glad that you're here. Heidi and Father Daniel and I will be back in about 2 weeks. We're looking forward to being with you then. Thank you again for listening.